You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to this Wednesday's release of the podcast where we're talking about macro and Bitcoin. So today's guest needs no introduction and he's backed by popular demand, and that's Mr. Luke Groman. When everything in the Ukraine kicked off, Luke was the first person I thought to bring on the show because he's such a wealth of information and he just has profound understanding of all the interdependencies between these markets. So we cover the macro situation in the Ukraine, Russia, China, the EU, the United States. We cover it in depth throughout this conversation. And of course, we also cover Bitcoin in there as well. So without further delay, here's my chat with the one and only Mr. Luke Groman.
You're listening to Bitcoin Fundamentals by the Investors Podcast Network. Now for your host, Preston Pysh.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Luke, when all this started happening, I just thought I need to talk to Luke or Lynn or somebody and capture your thoughts because my Lord, and we just talked recently, like how in the world has this much happened in that amount of time? It's just nuts.
Yeah, it's really been something, hasn't it?
It's crazy. Before we start, why in the world is Putin taking these pictures with these big long desks? It's like there's 20 seats you could put between him and these people that he's talking. It's just so strange.
It is. And it's, I don't know. No, I mean, it's, if he's reacting like, you know, half of our country is reacting to COVID, that's probably a pretty good guess, right? Like if you were the richest man in the world, like Putin was, or rumored to be, and you were a COVID germaphobe, you know, we'd probably be seeing these kinds of tables everywhere all over the U.S.
So weird. All right. On a serious note, the last time we talked, we were talking a lot about the dollar. We were talking about interest rates. We were talking about how the Fed was in a no-win situation based on the spreads. And then this thing happened. And I mean, I just want to start off by saying, blessings to the folks in the Ukraine and in this area and all the families that are affected by this. Our prayers are with you. And God, I hope this ends in the most peaceful, less stressful way for everybody involved. But with that, Luke, take it away with your thoughts on where we're at. Like, what does this mean? Where do we go? Take it away.
Maybe I'll start at the end, right? Which is, I think that 40 years of globalization, 40 years of disinflation, 40-year bond bull market on a real basis, at least, I think they all died on Wednesday night. I think Pax Americana likely ended on Wednesday night. I think a global marking to market of global relative power levels appears to be happening before our eyes. And I think the way that looks is the US and the EU are going to get downgraded relative to China and to Russia. And I think the multi-currency, multipolar world featuring multi-currency energy pricing, multi-currency reserves / gold reserves, I think that system, that world was likely fully born Wednesday night. So I think Wednesday night was, I think it was a really, really big moment. I think we're going to look back in history and see that. When I say the relative power levels being marked to market, what I mean by that is look, we could sanction Russia's energy. We could kick Russia's energy out of SWIFT. There's no reason we can't, except there is a reason we can't. Russia is too big a part of the energy market, and we have too much debt. And that's why I say is I think there's been there's been a lot of questions. Hey, what's Putin's grand strategy? I think the grand strategy is basically to trigger a reset. I think sort of the thing that I see a lot of discussion about tactics and reason, and let's set aside the possibility that he is sort of off his rocker, which we've seen some intelligence speculation via Marco Rubio on Twitter and others. Let's set that aside. It's a possibility, but it's sort of uninvestable, unknowable. And so, okay, so we set that aside. So what's the plan here? First off, I don't think Putin can do this without the, if not tacit, or tacit, if not explicit, blessing of Xi in China. Because this whole gambit fails if Xi walks away from Putin. Putin's done. So that's point one. I think in the aftermath of what the U.S. did with Iran regarding SWIFT in 2012, if you remember, we kicked Iran out of SWIFT or facilitated that, and the Iranian economy hyperinflated by October. And so I think Putin had to know this was coming. I think that China realizes that if Putin goes, China's next. And I think Xi, if China had any illusions that the United States could not starve him to death using the SWIFT system before last week, he knows now. And I think that's going to factor into his thought process. And so Putin and Xi need each other, perversely. Last week, they were already moving together. There was already this alliance. It was already threatening. It was already sort of awkward. We have now crammed them. They are now, I think, out of necessity, sort of tied together based on what happened last week. And maybe more important last week, what happened over last weekend. And I think ultimately what's happening here, what the gambit is that the reality of peak cheap energy, which you and I have talked about a number of times and prior conversations, where not that we're running out of oil, but the incremental oil supplies are getting more and more expensive. Ultimately, I think there's a calculus here that Putin did and that Xi did, which is they've been wanting to change this system for 15 years. You can go back throughout through history. I mean, March of 2009, the PBOC saying we need a new currency system. 2014, Putin saying the problem with the global economy is the dollar, and particularly the dollar's monopoly on oil pricing. It's killing the world economy. And I could literally go through page after page after page of these examples throughout history. And so I think a lot of people are missing, in my opinion, is that this isn't about what this is about. But I think the grand strategy here is very opportunistic, which is peak cheap energy means we cannot afford to sanction Russia's energy out of global markets without the global economy crashing, without the global bond market crashing. And they know that. It's pretty straightforward math when you kind of just start doing some back of the envelope stuff. And then that context, plus the context of something you and I have talked about ad nauseum in the last couple of shows, which is the fiscal position in the U.S., fiscal position in the EU, they are in no position to have a recession. If they have a recession, they're either going to default on their sovereign debt or the money printer going to go burr in both places. And so if you have those two pieces of information, and then you say, okay, let's go for it. And you say, well, they're going to sanction you out of SWIFT. Great. If your goal is to trigger a reset of the system where you have a multi-currency system, perfect. You know, if I have to take some pain to do that, if I'm Russia, I do it. Perfect. It was fascinating to me this weekend to watch the US and EU central banks do what they did as it relates to FX reserves. And I understand why they did it. I understand the strategy behind it. I'm not sure they understand what they really did, which is they completely discredited sovereign debt as an FX reserve, completely. I mean, if you're China, you're looking at this going, if I look sideways at Taiwan, they're gonna take away my FX reserves. And you know, to remind the audience, FX reserves at their core are just the aggregated savings of a nation's trade over any number of years.
Yeah.
So that's why I say I think everything has changed now, right? And there's a lot of different ways we can look at this. There's a lot of different ways China can respond, a lot of different ways Russia can respond, we can respond. But the bottom line to it is I think something very, very big happened last week. These, it was, I think, sort of the, you know, when you have these processes happening, right? I'm always asked, what's the trigger? What's the catalyst? How are we going to know? I think we know now. I think it just happened. And not just that that happened, but then the West's response to it is going to, I think things are now in motion. They can't be stopped.
All right. So I agree with everything you just said. I think that, the example that I've kind of been providing to people is, I think from Putin's standpoint, he was looking at this. He's looking at leadership across all of NATO. He's looking at the Ukraine, and he's looking at a president who, and I'm going to brand him in a way that I think maybe Putin was looking at him, is this guy's a comedian, literally. This guy was a comedian before he became president, right? He's like, I'm just going to run the queen right down the board, and I'm going to checkmate this situation. I'm going to basically take the Ukraine, and nobody's going to do anything about it. It's going to be the 2014 Crimea type situation. Only this time, this guy's going to get scared. He's going to step down. There's no way that they're going to go against my Russian military, right? And he's just going to roll over looking for a golden parachute, and Ukraine's going to be mine, and I'm going to basically demonstrate to NATO that they have no response, right? They have no response, and it's just for the taking at this point. And I think he did that move. He ran the queen down the board in order to do the checkmate, and he found out that the game wasn't over, and that the response was probably a 180 from what myself included. You know, if I was going to give myself a grade as to how I thought this was going to play out with them, with the Russian troops on the border, all the news, all the hoopla around it, I just kind of suspected that they were going to probably get what they want and just roll in there and take it. And there wasn't going to be too much of a response. And I'm telling you, I would give myself an F for what I thought was going to happen.
Me too.
And Zelensky's response has just been unbelievable. Unbelievable how the Ukraine's responded. If I was going to attribute it, I need to be asking you the questions.
But no, you're fine.
When I was looking at the response, I really think that in 2014 with the whole Crimea situation, I think that the Ukraine set up massive defensive positions for if this day would come. And I think anybody who probably lived in the Ukraine had a way different sight picture than ignorant people like me living over here in the U.S. as to how this would potentially play out if it ever happened. And obviously it did. But I think that anytime you're trying to go up against a well defended military position, it is way different than trying to attack and not accounting for the most important critical point, especially when you get beyond like day two, logistics. I mean, the logistics footprint that's now required to sustain them, the Russians, is just, I don't think a lot of people understand how complex that goes from a military.
I can only imagine.
To sustain these operations that they're now in. And wow. I mean, I was blown away when I was seeing all this information being published on Twitter of the aircraft, shoot downs, the air defense, everything. I was just awestruck by all of this. There's no question in that. Other than I think you agree with me. I think Zelensky's response was the thing I don't even think NATO was expecting that response out of him.
Yeah, I think it's been surprising. I mean, to everybody, it's been surprising.
So here we are. I think where are we at? Day six,
right? Yeah, now? Going into day six, right? Wednesday night. So day end of day five, going into day six over there.
Yeah. And I think this is where it really starts to get interesting. So the negotiations broke down. I think that was fully expected. I don't think you go in there and have the number of casualties that you've had on both sides and expect there to be any type of agreement at this point. And I think sunk cost bias, when you get into war and there's a lot of casualties on both sides, is just unimaginable how strongly entrenched I think both sides quickly become in a situation like this. And I guess where I'm going, Luke, is it doesn't seem like this is moving in a good direction. It seems like this is going to get, and who knows, by the time it airs tomorrow, this airs tomorrow night, who knows what's going to happen. But it really seems like this is not going in a good direction. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it speaks to sort of a fracturing of the world order that we've all come under, right? Because if China walks away from Russia, Russia's done. They've got nowhere else to go with the oil.
I don't see that happening. That's
not going to happen, and it can't happen because you can rest. You can almost guarantee that Putin's telling Xi, if Xi needs to be told, look, if I go, you're next. Make no mistake. They're going to do the same thing to your FX reserves. They're going to sanction them. They're going to take them. They are going to force a coup on you, and then they are going to put someone that they want in there to run China, sort of like they liked before that, and make sure that Taiwan is safe. And the challenge is that there's like you just said, there's two opposing viewpoints to what's happening here. And the two opposing viewpoints are not politically reconcilable. It's we're past the point where, you know, the naivete of, well, if we get the Chinese rich, then the Chinese Communist Party will change. Which was sort of what a lot of the, you know, the 30 years up until now was based on, and up until, you know, a few years ago at least was based on. And so you're in this weird situation where, look, when Russia defaulted in 98, the United States government was running a surplus. We were a unipolar power. China was a backwater. you had good demographics in this country. We had low debt to GDP. We hadn't spent $6 trillion securing Iraq's oil for China in Iraq. It was the situation was, and my point is that long-term capital still blew up and still almost took down the whole system with a much more stable system. And so this,
but that was back when it was not acceptable to manipulate the markets like they are today. I mean, that was pre, it's just obvious that we're manipulating markets. Right.
Oh yeah. Right. Like it was funny. I think I said something on Twitter last night. I said, "Watch, once the PPT, once the plunge protection team shows up today, you're going to see gold down, and you'll see the dollar up, and you'll see stocks up, and you'll see the ruble down, and you know, and I'm not saying the ruble didn't deserve to be down. It did clearly, but you're going to see as much down as they can. You'll see Russian stocks down, and you'll paint the picture. It's this sort of managing to optics instead of outcomes." All of which is fine, but then that gets back to the oil thing. That gets back to the energy question. You can manage to optics until the lights don't come on, until the heat doesn't come on. And so it goes back to your point of what's the response? Russia starts slowing gas to Europe, right? What happens? We've already got a German Bund market that's yielding zero with German PPI at 25. And the only reason that I understand there's a whole big slug of the bond market that owns bonds because they're regulated into it, or they have to, or it's, you know, it's matching liabilities, whatever. There's a big chunk of the bond market that is mindless buying. I get that. I understand it. But then there's a part of the bond market that owns bonds because they actually think inflation is going to come down in the second half of this year. They actually think supply chains are going to get better in the second half of this year. And after last week, I don't know how you can possibly think that supply chains are going to get better. I don't know how you could possibly think inflation is going to come back down unless this thing sort of wraps up quickly and cleanly.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Value investing in 2024 is lonely. You listen to the podcast and spend countless hours researching companies, but still feel like something is missing. What it is that you don't have others around you to help accelerate your learning efforts and your portfolio returns. This is exactly why we launched our TIP Mastermind community. In the TIP Mastermind community, we have nearly 100 passionate value investors joining our weekly live Zoom calls, sharing stock ideas, connecting with TIP hosts, joining our calls with special podcast guests like Chris Mayer and Gautam Bade, And most importantly, building lifelong relationships. We also host 2 live events per year in New York City and Omaha to take those relationships one step further. The TIP Mastermind community is exactly what I needed as an investor, so we decided to create it ourselves. Now I'm surrounded by so many like-minded investors who continually help me step up my game. We're capping the group at 150 members, so if you'd like to learn more, you can visit theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. That's theinvestorspodcast.com/mastermind. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So we came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news. And each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market. So I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And actually see they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
All right, back to the show.
But don't you think what we saw, and just so people know who maybe aren't intimately familiar with the bond market. So the bond market's getting bid through all of this, aggressively bid. Yields are down just in the past week since all this started happening. And don't you think that some of that is just the fixed income community just front running further central banking actions, like aggressive central bank burring into the market?
I think some of it's, I think it's probably primarily safety at this point, because I still think the big aha moment or the big oh shit moment coming for Wall Street that hasn't hit most of Wall Street yet is they're going to go burr into an inflation spike. They're going to go burr into $100 oil. They're going to go burr into $5 copper. And they're going to do that to contain yields. I mean, the yields we've seen so far, particularly in the long-dated treasury market, that makes sense, right? There is still a reflexive response. The question will then get to be when the inflation numbers get worse because of the supply chain disruptions.
Think about the fertilizer.
Yeah.
Like the food prices this fall are going to have to be astronomical.
Yeah, there'll be an increase and there'll be, energy. Like I said, like the reason the bond market, the reason the part of the bond market that has a decision to make about inflation is where it is because it believes that inflation is transitory. They believe that 7.5% CPI is going to 2% over the next year and a half. If I went to all that discretionary bond buyer, we'll call them, people with a choice with how they want to allocate their capital, and said CPI is going to be 8% for the next 5 years, I mean, and I know, if this thing goes on, it might be 8 or 10, it might be 12. I don't know. You're taking the world's biggest energy supplier, you're taking the world's factory, and we're in a fight with them. And
I mean, the only way you don't have that is if they just let the markets really sell off. Is that what would prevent us from hitting those kind of numbers, or do the numbers still manifest themselves?
No, you could, but that gets into, I think, the calculus that Putin has made in regards to this action, which is you can have the market sell off to create a bid for bonds, and it will work. We've seen it in the last week, 2 weeks. With that said, it can, as we saw in March of 2020, it can only work for so long until yields actually start rising, right? Because ultimately, there's a supply-demand problem without the central bank there. The thing that is so different now that Wall Street still, by and large, does not understand, that most investors still do not understand, is treasury spending, which is interest plus some of the other stimulus they're doing to juice tax receipts, to juice GDP. Treasury spending plus the entitlement paygos are 100% of tax receipts, with tax receipts at all-time highs. I mean, people say, oh, we're not spending that much on interest. We have tax receipts of $4 trillion last year. Just the entitlement paygos are $2.7 trillion. Before we spend another dime on anything else in the U.S. government, they're spending 65% of tax receipts, record tax receipts, boosted by a 12% nominal GDP, which was boosted by 8% inflation. $4 trillion, 65% entitlement paygos. Then you're going to have, I mean, if you add up treasury spending, entitlement paygos, and defense, which I categorize as the big three, that's 120% of tax receipts. So, and tax receipts are highly sensitive to consumption. And consumption, because consumption is 70% GDP, and consumption is highly sensitive on the margin to asset prices, stocks. So that's why I say they can let stocks fall for a bit to drive money back into bonds. But if they let it go too far, they're going to end up making the problem worse, not better, because what ends up happening is tax receipts start falling, and then you either have to let rates rise into a recession to drive more capital into bonds because there's not enough capital to go into the bonds, or you have money printer go burr, or you cut defense in the middle of a pissing contest with Russia. Not going to happen. Or you cut $2.7 trillion in entitlement paygos in the middle of a midterm election for the boomers. Not going to happen. Or you cut treasury yields below what they are. You can't go below zero with the reserve currency. Option four is money printer go burr. And I really think that's the bigger game, right? You say it's you know, always know the game you're playing, which game you're playing. I don't think Western strategists fully appreciate the game they're playing. I think they are playing the Ukraine game. And I think what Russia and China are going is like, let's just cause chaos here. This is like the US's Afghanistan strategy, right? Like, let's just throw a Molotov cocktail in there. We're going to take some casualties. We'll get bogged down. Maybe we win. Maybe we don't. But the bigger game is the resulting chaos. The energy market can't take it. The bond market can't take it. The Western sovereigns and the U.S. and EU specifically, their fiscal situation, they are in no position to do anything.
What do you say to the person who would look at Putin and say, well, he might not make it? Because internally in their country, I would imagine it's just rife with a populace that really isn't too excited about all this. I would suspect, but I don't know.
I don't know either. I saw Western polling ahead of time that said that I was reading the other day. I forget which media. I think it was U.S. mainstream media that said it. But the Western polling ahead of time was that Russian citizenry was in favor 2-1 to going into Ukraine. Which, if that's the case, who knows? We all know that polling is. But no, I think that's right. Right. But again, that then, if you have chaos in Russia was in 98, when literally the economy was perfect. I mean, like nothing was going wrong. We were running surpluses. We were, the biggest problem the United States had in 1998 was Monica Lewinsky. Think about that. That was the big crisis in 1997, 1998. And in that environment where Russia was smaller, where oil was $20 a barrel, Russia was like hanging on.
We were trying to define what is was or is as.
Well, that's a separate discussion. I saw someone the other day saying, well, we signed this agreement with Ukraine to defend them. And to be harsh, I'm like, you signed it with Bill Clinton, who was debating the meaning of the word is. Like, that's, that's dangerously close to politics. I won't, we'll stop there.
So two things for me that, just kind of makes this very concerning. The direction this is going is you had, Belarus shooting what appear, and again, this is, who knows how valid all of this is, but it appears that they were shooting munitions from their territory into Ukraine on, you know, obviously supporting Russia. And then you had Turkey cutting off the access to the Black Sea to the Russian Navy. So here you have two countries that are supporting, one supporting Russia, one supporting Ukraine, that are now actively involving themselves into this fight. And I'm looking at this and saying to myself, oh my Lord, like, I suspect that this just is not going to go over well as far as just looking at historical implications when you start getting active participants that are outside the two nation states that are at war. It has an ability to spiral out of control very quickly. You have Chechen fighters that are now coming into the Ukraine. Who knows where else they might be deployed, depending on some of the other actors that are involved. And I'm just looking at all this and I'm saying, this just does not seem like it's going to work itself out in a quick kind of way, unless something that's just unforeseen happens, like an assassination or something that like is just kind of not in the card or doesn't appear to be in the cards.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And for me, it goes back to that, to the point of, you know, when Russia was a lot smaller, a lot less significant, when the system was much more stable, Russia collapsing was enough to nearly collapse the financial system. It required a Fed bailout of long-term capital to keep the U.S. banking system from collapsing, the global banking system from collapsing. And so, to me, when you then factor in, you know, the China angle, you know, there was a white paper that China put out right at the end of last year that not a lot of people paid attention to, called Export Controls. And it read to me like a veiled threat, basically, of we will weaponize supply chains. We have to start prioritizing exports based on our own domestic use, right? So that's punchline being that best case from the financial, I don't know on the kinetic side. I agree with you 100% that it could, what we're starting to see with some of these other nations getting drawn in has the risk of things spiraling, but I only say that based on historical analogs reading. I don't have any particular expertise in that, so I'm not the right guy to ask about that. But what I do know is when you look at the relative size, the relative leverage in the system, and these events, it just goes back to that point of like disinflation. No, it's over. Supply chain improvement. Yeah, no. Inflation's going to get better. No. And to be clear, I think what we saw from the US and EU, I didn't realize this till today, but apparently central bank FX reserves historically had enjoyed sovereign immunity. So the fact that the US and EU central banks did that to the Russian central bank is a violation of international norm, arguably an act of war on some way, shape, or form. It is likely to elicit a response. What is that response? Does Russia slow pump the natural gas into Europe? Yeah, it's probably a pretty good bet. Do they mess with the LNG terminals from a hacking standpoint? Because if those things go down, you know, the Liberty boats are going to all pile up in the Med or in the North Sea looking to get the gas in, and they're not going to be able to offload it. Are they going to mess with electric cyber warfare here? Gosh knows we've heard plenty of warnings about that. I mean, you know, when I saw what I saw last week, I told my wife, go get some extra cash out of the bank. Go to the we got to go to the grocery store this weekend. We need to make sure we've got plenty of stuff in the freezer, because I don't think people in the West are thinking of, listen, what happens if your credit card goes down for 2 weeks? And Pippa Malmgren wrote a great paper, a great Substack last week, it was called Electrons Are the New Bullets. But I would highly encourage listeners to read that. I think it's very, you know, Pippa, brilliant woman, but not just a brilliant woman, but she served in the Bush administration. She knows of what she speaks. And of course, her father, Harold Malmgren, served with Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Cold War veteran at the highest levels. And the point of her paper is that electrons, the internet, that, you know, all of this can be weaponized. You know, the exchanges are on a chip, basically, is what she says, right? So, you know, what happened, and this is her question, not mine, what happens if markets stop functioning on a regular basis? Not if they go down permanently, that's not the issue. What if they're just intermittent, right? Where you start questioning capital allocation, you start these sort of fundamental, and that's where too, I think, in addition to the kinetic stuff that you just referenced, I think the Western populace is totally unready for anything like this, mentally, absolutely, physically, anything.
Absolutely.
I mean, my kids today, my boys, you know, I got a 19-year-old and a 20-year-old and 18-year-old, and my 18-year-old goes, "Dad," you know, going around on Instagram or whatever they're looking at, you know, Columbus, Ohio is number 6 on the whatever list they were looking at of nuclear targets for the Russians, right? So we're in Cleveland, Ohio. Columbus, they're like, "Oh my God." Now, who knows if it's even true or not? But like, we, from 3 months, we've gone from the president of the United States saying the unvaxxed are going to, you know, at risk of hospitalization and death over this cold winter, to today, the president going, "Don't worry about nuclear attack. It should be fine." And it's like, holy cow. Like, is that how fast everything went? Like, I just think there's this, you know, when I saw the reaction of my boys, like, I don't think mentally as a country, I don't think physically we're prepared for any type of retaliation. I mean, my whole life, everyone's whole life, it's always been over there.
We're not even talking about Canada shutting down bank accounts for people that made $50 donations to a crowdfunding protest, right? We're not even talking about a massive convoy that's en route to Washington, D.C. right now to the tune of thousands of trucks. I don't even know what the number is up to right now, but I think this is going to be a major story in the coming week, right, or 2 weeks.
I think the banks in Canada had a very short, very one-sided, and very loud conversation with Trudeau. That's what I think happened.
But the trust is breaking down.
To your point,
yeah, of getting money out of the bank. I just don't think people, I think they've been so lulled to sleep, expecting that I can just go out and this is just how the world functions. And I think we are in a situation where there is something massive brewing. I don't know what the hell it is, but there is something really massive brewing. It just feels like that. I mean, I hope I'm wrong.
I do too, right? And I hope, and that's something to think about too. And who knows, this might have even factored into Putin's calculus, right? Maybe he's desperate. Maybe any of those things. But the Russians are no strangers to currency collapses. This is not their first rodeo. This is actually 30% in the ruble. Like, I have friends that grew up there. they had two hyperinflations in the 90s. The currency collapsed again in 08, and it collapsed again in 14. So it's like, it's not like America where everyone's just has all their cash sitting in the bank. Everything's fine, right? I mean, you hold your currency in dollars. I mean, there's record purchases of gold last year in Russia by the citizenry. Like, there's an understanding that fundamentally in Russia, that currency collapses, number one, it's not safe. And number two, having lived through that, there's much more robust, just experience, right? You store food, you have a garden, you do, you know, there's these angles that once you live through that kind of thing, it's a little different than, hey, we've been running just in time for 30 years, what can possibly go wrong kind of a thing. And I'm reminded too, as we get into this, right, with Russia and China, I'm reminded a little bit of the stories of World War One, right? Where going into World War One, number one, there was global, that was at the end of globalization 1.0, and there was, I forget who wrote the book, but basically it was irrational to go to war because everyone was intertwined with trade. And the guy said, listen, I didn't say impossible. I said irrational, you know, in the aftermath. And he was right. He didn't say impossible. He said irrational. But the other point to that was every combatant going into World War I thought they were going to go in and be home by Christmas because they had all served in, you know, Africa and you know, India and these colonies of the great European powers in the 10 to 15 years prior. And they had been using machine guns against guys with old rifles or spears in some cases and just mowed them down. And so they figured, all right, we're going to go there. We're going to mow down the Germans. And to your point about the defensive positions, when they got machine guns and they got machine guns, it was a very, very different story. And my point is that when you have two near peer adversaries, it's a very different story. And that's a very different story for us versus recent conflicts in the United States. And it's a very different story for the Russians versus near term. Right. So there's this desperation, I think, to some level on the Russian side, this frustration on their side. And I think some probably overconfidence on their side and on our side, all feeding into what you described earlier, combined with all this other. So I think it's, I don't disagree. It's a very discomforting cocktail. And then when you talk about the domestic side, which again, I don't know who gave Trudeau that advice. It was terrible advice because now they opened Pandora's box. There's no going back. It's been revealed. It's the same thing as when we use SWIFT on Iran. I think in hindsight, we will see that to have been a very penny wise, pound foolish decision, right?
$50.
Right. I mean, if you're Alabama and you're playing St. Mary's of the Blind, right, you don't put your best trick play on film so that LSU can see you, right? You save that. You don't, you know, so why are we using SWIFT against Iran? It made little sense. We should have, because had we not used that against Iran, then when we deployed it against Russia, they'd have been like, oh my God, right? Like, there's no surprises now. I mean, you saw Jamie Dimon at the end of today say, there are workarounds, and this is now a threat. Obama talked about this in 2015, that the reason we pulled back on some of the unilateral sanctions against Iran was because there was a threat to the U.S. dollar's reserve status. Said we couldn't sanction, we can't dictate the economic and energy policies of every nation on earth because it will threaten the dollar's reserve status. And so there's this direct game, there's the threats within this direct game, and then there's this big meta game, you know, of that I think is ultimately sort of the real. It's like, hey, maybe we get Iraq, maybe we get Ukraine, maybe we don't. We don't think we're going to lose tremendous amount. You know, it's, you know, we'll get in a scrap, but that scrap in a peak cheap energy world with U.S. sovereign debt and fiscal situation and the EU debt and fiscal situation as precarious as they are, that should be more than enough to trigger money printer go burr into a energy spike and inflation spike, and that should be enough to trigger basically a systemic reset.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, this is Clay Fink. Before I became a host on We Study Billionaires, I hosted one of our other podcasts called Millennial Investing. Kyle Grieve and Patrick Donnelly have done an incredible job now hosting that show and taking it to the next level. For example, Kyle recently hosted an amazing episode with Chris Mayer on episode 310 that gave a masterclass on serial acquirers. Serial acquirers are a very interesting business model with very strong multi-bagger potential. This makes them potentially the dream business for stock pickers like us. Kyle also hosted some other amazing episodes packed full of timeless investing wisdom with guests like Lawrence Cunningham, Robert Hagstrom, and Brian Feraldi. Millennial Investing, along with We Study Billionaires, is definitely one you should add to your arsenal of top podcasts. Check it out today by searching for Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and clicking the follow button. Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account. When it comes to financial advice, you gotta trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? For me, nothing beats having my next flight free thanks to NerdWallet. Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
So you had mentioned China a little bit. One of the things that I hear just tons of people talking about, maybe just because it gets more sensationalized when you do this bit, everybody's just saying Taiwan, this would be the chance for China to go after Taiwan. And I'm just kind of curious what you think the probabilities of something. I think the probabilities is higher than what many that are just writing it off saying, I think the probabilities are higher than that. I'm just kind of curious whether you think that that's an opportunity for them if they are colluding together, Russia and China. Is this the moment where they then go in that direction to really kind of lay the 1-2 punch?
I don't know. The people that I really respect on that say that, like you said, it's basically a low chance of happening. The thing that's caught my attention as it relates to Taiwan and China is, for example, I saw a chart from David Goldman a few weeks ago showing that Taiwanese exports to mainland China since 2019 are up nearly 2x. By way of comparison, Taiwanese exports to the United States since 2019, according to whatever U.S. agency tracks it, are up 45%. And the United States is having a semiconductor shortage. So you tell me what it sounds to me like Taiwan's voting with their checkbook, or Taiwan is actually riding. Yeah. They're playing both sides, which is what I would do too. Their economic future is clearly in China, but they want to maintain their political independence, which is clearly with the United States. And so to me, it looks like they are, the shipment numbers, the growth rates since 2019 would suggest that they are giving preferential treatment to the Chinese while benefiting from our umbrella. Which to me sounds like there needs to be a conversation there. But again, when I say this re-rating of political relative power standings, this is another measure. What exactly are we going to do, right? Let's say I'm right. Let's say that the Taiwanese they are giving Chinese preferential treatment, and they are doing so under our military and protection umbrella from the Chinese. What are we going to do? Back away? No, we can't, because if they go with them, then we're worse off, right? So there's this. So you look at the game theory of it. Taiwanese relative power is gaining relative to America, and by virtue of that, Chinese's relative power is gaining relative to America. And at the moment, there isn't a darn thing we can do about it, as far as I can tell. Now, I've been very encouraged to see. In the last 6 months, we have seen 3 semiconductor fabs announced in the U.S., right? We've seen Taiwan Semi in Arizona. We've seen, I think, a Samsung facility in Texas. And we've seen Intel come here to Ohio, where they're talking about making Columbus, the Columbus, Ohio region, one of the biggest semiconductor production regions in the world, which sounds awesome. And I think it's the right thing to do. I think it's very good for Ohio. It's very good for the U.S. that said, it's all of this is still on the come. We're still probably several years from this. There's probably some generational in terms of technology issues, whatever. But for my purposes, again, it ties back to the initial statement. This isn't disinflationary.
No.
This is not transitory. This is so inflationary. It's so non-transitory. It's such a, and again, the way the world worked for 50 years was, is you guys make the semiconductors, send them to us. We send you the dollars, and then you take the dollars and you send them back into treasuries. And now we're saying we're out. We're just going to make them ourselves. And so here too, there's a message to the Taiwanese. I think it's the right thing to do to them to say, listen, you're benefiting from our protection. You're taking care of China. Okay, great. We're going to start making stuff here, which is the right thing to do. But then it also communicates to the Taiwanese, all right, you know, I don't know if the Americans are going to be here in 20 years, 15 years, 10 years. What? How does that start to change strategic thinking? I don't know. But these are the types of conversations that have to be happening around the world. And these are conversations that were not happening 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 25 years ago.
So the Russian minister says, we are working on digital one world currency for trade. Came out of the local media, I think yesterday.
Yep, saw it.
What are your thoughts on that one?
I think this ties back into the relative power situation revisions. And I think it ties into something I tweeted today, which was, nominally, the Russian currency is the ruble, and it's getting killed. But functionally, the Russian currency is oil and gas, and it's rising against everything, and it has been rising against everything. And that leaves them with some unappreciated or underappreciated options, potentially, right? So if we are willing to completely cut off their oil and gas, and you could never completely, but mostly cut it off, and again, I don't think we can do that with collapsing our system.
Can China and India consume their production?
Yes, but the logistics are problematic for a decent chunk of it, right? So there's some pipeline consumption issues, some displacement, some grade stuff. And again, that's above my pay grade. But the little bit I've looked at is that there's not enough pipeline capacity to do it today. The pipelines would take a while because it's not easy ground to build over. Presumably, you could use it, you know, use tankers for a lot of it, but then I don't know the grade, you know, medium, heavy, light, sweet, you know, in terms of the different refinery needs, and then who that bumps out, right? In terms of the implications of that. So, top down, oversimplified, yeah, right. I mean, ultimately, the demand for energy is infinite. I would love to take, a G5, Gulfstream 5 everywhere I want on vacation and, you know, consume a bunch of oil. If oil was free or very cheap, I would do that. It's not, right? So the whole, is there enough demand? What's the price, right?
You'd first have to become a strong advocate of ESG before you did that, Luke.
I literally just saw a headline on Bloomberg talking about that. The Europeans are talking about reclassifying weapons makers as ESG so that they can get cheaper financing. I'm like, satire's dead. No, so if we're willing to completely sanction the energy out, they have energy, they have some options, right? This is the real currency. And so people say, well, how can they defend it? Let's start with just basic and work our way up with their options. What if Putin came out tomorrow and said, I'm only taking ruble for my energy? Let's just think about this mechanically. The Europeans are going to have to start selling euros to buy rubles.
Yep.
And the Americans are going to have to start doing the same thing because we import whatever on net, I think 600,000 barrels a day from the Russians and whatever gas we get from them. If any,
I mean, right? Europe has no options in this. At least not in the interim. Like they, right. whatever they would try to transition to, you're what, 2 years out from whatever that is?
Yeah.
Would be nuclear, I would imagine.
Well, and they're talking about delaying some nukes, you know, delaying some closings of some nukes. And again, there are guys out there that know what that would imply in terms of reducing natural gas demand, daily demand, but I'm not one of those guys. And it's also important too, Europe is shutting down their biggest natural gas field, Groningen, in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
This year. It was supposed to be shut down in 2030. then 2029. Now it's going to be shut down this year.
But they have to be pivoting from whatever those decisions were at this point.
They have to. The Groningen problem, though, is some of it is geological. Some of this stuff is like peak oil stuff, peak cheap oil stuff, right? Like these fields all follow some version of a Hubbert's curve or a bell curve. You find it, you produce more, you get to a peak, and then you get on the other side. So there's some geological issues associated with Groningen. I think they could extend it. I don't know how long they could, but it's not simply, hey, you know, this isn't green, and so let's just stop doing that. Some of it is like, you know, this is causing, you know, ground issues, geological issues. It's not there, water cut, whatever. Okay, so the options Russia has. Option number one, tomorrow Putin says, hey, I'm only taking rubles. All of a sudden, the Europeans have to sell euros and buy rubles, right? So now, and this is why I say this relative power side, right? The sign that we can't sanction his energy out because it'll collapse our system shows that there's some power there. There's a card to be played. So now you would be in a situation where the Europeans and the Americans are defending the ruble for Putin because we need his energy. Okay, so that's, I think, sort of tier one. You go to tier two, and these become more nuclear, right? New options. And that's, a digital currency, right? What if Putin comes out and says, listen, we have a gold, and I know we're going to set this discussion aside. We have a gold blockchain token, you know, digital currency here, gold-backed digital currency. And we are only taking, we're only taking gold for our oil. Physical only. It's got to be on this blockchain, right? That's physical only, this digital token. And the Chinese are on board, and the Venezuelans are on board, and the Iranians are on board, and the whole slew of, you know, of usual suspects. Now Putin can control the ratio of gold to oil that he wants to transact at and use his oil to revalue gold. By revaluing gold higher using his oil, he's going to be creating dollar reserves for himself with his gold reserves, which he still has control over. And oh, by the way, he needs more of because the U.S. and European central banks just took 2/3 of his reserves, right? I think I saw the number was 630 billion reserves, and I think 130, 150 billion is sitting in gold in Russia. So he needs to get that number back up based on what they just did. Again, because he has energy, all he has to do is say, and this is, you know, oversimplification, the Chinese and I are transacting at 1,000 barrels per ounce. And this to me is the nuclear option, right, on the financial side, because now this throws it back into the lap of the Americans. It's very poorly understood in the West that the Achilles heel to the dollar system is the COMEX and the London unallocated gold markets. They are very highly levered, in London in particular, highly levered, small sliver of physical underpinning the whole thing, right? And the only way you can take the bottom Jenga block of physical out is if you are a sovereign with nukes, right? I mean, a reasonable size hedge fund could create a run on COMEX if they wanted to, but they don't. There's a message there, right? So Russia says, okay, 1,000 barrels an ounce. And this is where we're doing deals at as a result of sanctions, because we need to make the gold market big enough to handle the oil market because you've kicked me out of SWIFT. And you've hurt my reserves. Okay, and China's happy with that deal. And, you know, the Venezuelans, the Iranians are on board too. So now you have a big chunk of the global export oil market transacting in gold at 1,000 barrels an ounce. Well, the law of one price says you can't have the same price for the same, or two different prices for the same commodity. And in America, the gold to oil ratio is give or take 20. And so the Americans are going to have a choice at that point, right? If he's doing it at 1,000 barrels an ounce, if we cannot, you know, basically, if we don't stop trade with China and all trade with Russia and everybody else, right, there's going to be leakage through that whole system. 1,000 barrels an ounce means the Americans have to decide if they want $2 oil, right, $2,000 gold divided by 1,000, $2 oil, in which case the entire shale sector is gone. And now we need to start importing probably about 10 million barrels a day from the Russians who are, or the Venezuelans or the Iranians who are only taking gold. Or we have to write up gold to his number. Again, this is simple math. This is not where I think it's going, but 1,000 barrels an ounce, $100 a barrel, $100,000 an ounce gold, you have a new currency system. Treasuries are no longer primary reserve of the whole thing. gold now is. And oh, by the way, let's remark Putin's gold at $100,000 an ounce. Does he need any more dollars? No, he does not. He's got all the dollars he needs. And people say, well, he can't transact them. What's he need from us? China will give him everything he needs.
And Luke, so you're saying that this blockchain-based gold-backed system, so the digital currency would be then traded globally.
This is purely hypothetical. But yeah, if you had maybe not globally, maybe just for energy, maybe just for energy between them. I don't know, because to your point to Bitcoin advocates' point, the problem with gold is you gotta audit it, right? If it's on a blockchain, that is...
He's controlling the ledger.
It's auditable.
Yeah, and I mean, that's my whole... You already know where I'm going with my...
right. I mean, it ultimately, I think that kind of outcome would be tremendous for Bitcoin, too, to be clear, because this is the fire that the Western banker, that the Western policymakers have now started, that they are playing with. And I don't think they realize they're playing with this. And this is, to me, when I see, like, my Twitter feed is probably 99% Russia's screwed, we've got them down, Russia has no cards to play. You're talking about, you know, one of the great strategists at the senior political level in the world. Yeah, maybe he's just lost his mind and it's that simple and this is a bad gambit.
I think the way to go about this is to give him the benefit of the doubt so that you can sharpshoot and think through all the different scenarios that could potentially play out.
You have to. Yeah. I think you have to. And people just aren't, right? There's just this, they have this energy production. And as long as they have this energy production and remains in power. I think your point there is very, very astute, right? Because if you can get a Yeltsin in there and you can, basically start to, do what you did in the late 90s, which is, there's a great article, The Harvard Boys Do Russia, right? So Jeff Sachs and Larry Summers and Stan Fisher go over there. They start sort of, selling off the pieces of the Soviet empire for pennies on the dollar to Western interests. Then this can all sort of work out. But it's interesting when you red team things, you got to sort of put yourself in the other guy's shoes. And there's none of that being done. I mean, there's a book called Genocide, Russia and the New World Order. And it's written by a guy named Malcolm Glazyev. And Glazyev, at least as of a couple years ago, was one of Putin's senior economic advisors. And this book is fascinating because he lays out in great detail, great economic analysis, the case that the IMF's shock therapy under the leadership of Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury, and Stan Fisher, former Vice Chair of the Fed, he names both gentlemen specifically, IMF shock therapy in the Russians' case did as much economic damage to Russia as Hitler did in the 40s, as Napoleon did when he invaded Russia, and as the White Revolution did in whatever, 1917, 1918. And so do I believe those numbers? I don't know. But do I know that a senior Putin economic advisor has run these numbers and believes these numbers? Yes. And this book was written 9 years ago, right? So my read on this the whole time is not, I believe these numbers, I think they're right. My read on this book is, numbers might be right, might be wrong, but they believe these numbers. And if they believe these numbers, what are the odds the Russians are going to roll over and let a NATO country next to them, they are going to go to the mattresses at some point on this. And they finally just did.
So I just want to go back just briefly, because I think the Bitcoin community would be very upset with me if I didn't go back and readdress the gold comment.
Yeah, I sort of got off topic there a second. Yeah.
No. This is good. But for people who are listening to this that really kind of want to understand why a Bitcoiner would be looking at the scenario that you outlined, I think that it's plausible that they could go down that path with a digital currency that they're saying is backed by gold, they obviously don't have to prove anything as to how much gold they actually have. I'm sure that they would generically try to provide some type of audit of how much they're starting out with that would supposedly back this digital currency that could then be shot all around the world in a quote unquote trustless way, even though we clearly know that they're managing whatever ledger they've got. In my humble opinion, blockchain, the term blockchain is thrown around so liberally as if it's actually decentralized today that most, and when I say most, probably 95% plus just hear blockchain are like, oh, well, it's decentralized. There's not anything anybody can do to shut it down, right?
Yeah.
When in reality, I really think that the only thing out there is literally Bitcoin that's actually decentralized, because anybody who runs a full node, like myself and many others out there, know that you can't shut that down when the memory to run one of these things is so small and so decentralized, and we're the gatekeepers of what the ledger is, right? You get into any of these other blockchains, the requirement to house these things, I mean, it's like AWS, right? Like you have to have a web server to host it, makes it not decentralized.
The purpose.
That's right.
Yeah. Let's rerun that scenario. Let's say he does that scenario with Bitcoin, let's just say scenario C, right? So it's, you know, hey, you better pay me in ruble. B, I'm going to gold. C, I'm going to Bitcoin. Okay.
I just can't even imagine what that would do.
Right. But it would think about the implications of that, right? Now it is truly decentralized. You've got oil bidding for Bitcoin, and there's nothing the West can do to stop it. There's nothing the East can do to stop it. It's
I know one thing, Bitcoiners would be villainized real fast.
they'd be villainized real fast. Quite frankly, everyone would probably go into hiding because the number would be so big. Like, why? You wouldn't want anyone to know you owned any.
Yeah.
Which I
clearly don't. And there's many others that like me that have just lost our coins. But we like talking about it.
Right?
We love talking about it. Yes.
Yeah. No, I don't think, and this is something else I've talked about a little bit. I don't think China would want that though, because I think we talked a little bit about this on our last show, I think China kicked out Bitcoin miners, not because they disliked the competition. I mean, they probably did, but I don't think that was the main reason. I think the main reason is they have a power issue, and they have a power issue because they have a water issue.
But Luke, let's pull the thread on this. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but what if China says, well, we're going to peg our central bank digital currency to Bitcoin, right? But all of our citizens have to use the central bank digital currency. I think over there, most of them would just be like, okay, sure, we'll just use it. Like, I don't think that there's, I don't think you have as many people in China that are just freedom zealots like myself and many other people inside of this country, right? That understand the privacy implications and the damage that can be done with a central bank digital currency.
Yeah, right. Politically, they just want shit to work, right? They just, as long as the system works, then they're and that would not be dissimilar to what the U.S. ran, right? With gold from 46 through 71, right? It was illegal for Americans to own. We couldn't own gold technically, but we were settling. I mean, there was a 737 flying gold discs to Saudi Arabia every friggin' week, right? For a number of years in the 60s for the Royal, and so. It's interesting, right? I think that would make sense. And that would, again, be another, it would be a huge trump card that the Russians could play. But again, they have the option to play that because they have this energy. When you look at what he's doing, in my opinion, it has always been, I think he understands. The math is very clear, right? He doesn't need to report monthly numbers. He does not need to report quarterly return numbers. He just needs to look out and go, the Americans are the reserve currency. The Americans have 70 million boomers. They owe them $100 trillion. they're going to print it all. And when they do, they will have effectively stolen all the oil I shipped to them for dollars over the years. They will via inflation. And so I am going to stop storing their bonds. I'm going to store gold. And then Bitcoin came along and has arguably done a better job. But I think that's his whole game. What's that?
He stopped doing that in 2018 when he sold all the bonds he had, right? Yeah. I would argue maybe that's when the premeditation of all of this maybe was initiated, was in 2018 when he sold all the bonds he had.
Yeah, I think that's very possible. And it's been, I think they and China both have been under the gun, right? China has been running into increasing water issues, which means they're running into less food security. Russia can help address that. The Chinese in the first half of 2018 ran their first current account deficit in 20 years, right? So that, I think, spurred them to accelerate yuan oil. Yuan commodity pricing, which we've seen a significant acceleration of since then, because that gives them flexibility around their current account, right? I mean, people don't understand when I say that. Here's what it means. In 2018, if China would have imported 100% of their commodity imports in yuan instead of dollars, it would have increased their their trade surplus by $800 billion. So China's dollar supplies would have gone up by $800 billion if they had paid in all euros, or excuse me, in all yuan, right? So when I say there's another lever, they're never going to do 100% yuan. It's not really in their interest, and I don't think anyone would ever take it all per se. However, do 10% of that. That's $100 billion, right? And the commodity prices are way lower than they were today. So you just do 10% of your commodities in yuan, you free up $100 billion. China, yuan currency frees up the risk, or ends the risk, of a Chinese currency crisis. So I think they and the Russians were both working together on that. The Russians were very early in selling oil in yuan. They started doing it in 2014. The Holy Grail gas deal was signed in May of 2014 between the two. The terms were rumored to be in yuan. It was a 30-year massive deal. So I think this thing's been, I think they've realized they've needed each other. And I think why they feel like they need each other is, I think they know the currency system is screwed. I think they see the reserve currency issuer owes its boomers $100 billion or $100 trillion, and it's going to print it all. And when they do, the dollar reserves, the dollar bonds these countries hold, will be made worthless in real terms.
I think you're exactly right. And I think most of the West, Europe, US, don't see it that way. At least a lot of the political figures that are in charge, I think some of your central bankers kind of understand that this is coming off the trail, off the tracks. But I think a lot of your elected officials in all of these countries have no clue that
they have no idea
that
they have
any no idea this is happening.
No. And I think ultimately that ties back to sort of initial point of, okay, what's the game they're playing? And I think there's the game, and then there's the metagame. And I think the metagame is this system is screwed. There is no, this thing is going, you know, and post COVID, it is really done. You know, that's where the reserve currency issuer can't cover his true interest expense out of tax receipts. It's over. It's done. He's got to print the game's over. Okay. You know, the game is, hey, let's try to grab some territory and create some chaos. If we get some territory, great. But like, you know, Putin, I think it was Putin who said it. I remember seeing an interview with him. I think it's him. I may be misquoting, but it was basically like, if you know there's going to be a fight, pick the spot where the fight's going to happen, because that will give you the advantage, or pick the spot where and when, right? And that's, you know, and I think it was an alluding to a street fight, right? You never want to go into somebody else's country to fight if you can avoid it. But, mentally, I think that might be what the metagame is, which is, listen, system's done. We don't know what the trigger is going to be. You know,
let me talk about one more thing that I found really interesting was the weaponization of finance against all the high net worth individuals in Russia.
Right.
I actually think that this might actually be one of the most powerful tools against Putin that could potentially cause a lot of this to transition more peacefully than the path that it currently appears to be going on. How powerful do you think that force is? I kind of think that you start turning some of these billionaires, you start collecting their yachts, you start shutting down all their payments and things like that. You start taking their mansions in all these various locations all over the world. I think he's got an absolute disaster on his hands internally with those actions. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think it's a smart way of putting pressure on him and making him uncomfortable. It's unknowable. I don't know his relationship structure and status with these people, how much he's met with them before saying, listen, this is going to get messy. That's the unknown. If he met with these guys and they are, sworn allegiance and sort of a suicide pact to listen, we're going down with the ship, we're winning, or we're burning the boats, right? If they swore together to burn the boats, yeah. But then again, you can swear to burn the boats, but then when it's time to light them, that's a different animal entirely, right? So yeah, I think they make sense. It's targeted. It's interesting. I tweeted something the other day as a side note. Say, right, if you say that the small number of people get together and sort of control things and plan things, you're a conspiracy theorist. Yet, what are we doing with sanctions? Targeting a small number of people to actually change something, right? Like, yeah. It's one or the other is true, but not both.
Luke, is there anything else that you think is a really important piece to this that I haven't asked or that we haven't covered? So, and before you do that, say the name of the book again. You mentioned a book there that I wanted to write down.
By Glazyev?
Yes.
It was called Genocide, Russia and the New World Order. And it delves into the shock therapy from their side of things.
Anything else that we're forgetting?
No, I think the big thing is really just, what's the metagame here? And there's just no consideration that there even is one. And I think that's actually the real goal here is just.
Totally agree with you. All right. Thank you so much for making time to come on and chat.
Absolutely.
And I learn so much every time I talk to you. Give people a hand off. Definitely highlight your book. They're back behind you there for people that are watching this on YouTube. But highlight your book and your macro thematic research that you do is just phenomenal.
Thank you.
Give people a hand off to some of this stuff.
Sure. So, if you go to our website, fftt-llc.com, give you an update on different research product offerings, what we're up to, et cetera. You can find me on Twitter as well at Luke Groman. The book's over here to my left or right, wherever it is on the screen. Wrote those. They're fictional. Mr. X is a fictional sovereign creditor of the United States, and the books are written in a Socratic method with me interviewing him. And so he, Mr. X is an agglomeration, if that's a word, of a number of different actual people in my mind, and so it's they're actually probably pretty helpful for these days in terms of understanding some of the motivations of potential motivations of what some of the bigger games on the financial side in particular, but geopolitics as well in terms of what might be afoot. So,
Luke, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me on. It's great talking again, my friend.
If you guys enjoyed this conversation, be sure to follow the show on whatever podcast application you use. Just search for We Study Billionaires. The Bitcoin-specific shows come out every Wednesday, and I'd love to have you as a regular listener. If you enjoyed the show or you learned something new or you found it valuable, if you can leave a review, we would really appreciate that. And it's something that helps others find the interview in the search algorithm. So anything you can do to help out with a review, we would just greatly appreciate. And with that, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you again next week.
Thank you for listening to TIP. To access our show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.